Okay, so welcome, Elaine. I appreciate you taking the time to come on to chat today, in particular about basic income. Just as a bit of background, you are an associate professor at Queen's University. You happen to also be the head of the gender studies department. You're a co-founder of Kinks in Action Group for Basic Income Guarantee. You have a lot of expertise in poverty, food security, and health. So thanks a lot for taking the time today, Dr. Power. Appreciate it.
I'm delighted. I'm really delighted to be here.
And so I'm really interested to talk about basic income specifically, especially in light of what's been going on with the Canada Emergency Response Benefit and the other government assistance programs that are out there and that have been set up. And I know that your involvement in research, in particular, your pitch on basic income is you know, extremely germane to this topic. So I guess for starters, explain... because you guys were, in your group, were one of the first to explain it to me. Tell people what basic income, the basic income project or basic income guarantee is.
Well, I think basic income is a floor, a financial floor under Canadians. And I think the Canada Emergency Benefit is an example of that. The CERB is an example of a basic income. It's not quite the basic income we imagine, because we would like to see it extended to everyone whose income is low, but it's a really good example of a basic income. So basically it's a guarantee that from our perspective, that everyone would have an income that is at least at the poverty line. And so when I say we, I'm a supporter of the Basic Income Canada Network. I'm not speaking on their behalf, but I'm supporting their position and using their materials.
Yeah. And I found it really interesting because I had been involved in politics municipally for about 8 years or so, and really didn't understand much about basic income and the concept of it. But I had seen a lot of the delivery of the existing services from primarily the provincial government, but helped to be funded by from the federal government as well at the municipal level, because municipalities deliver a lot of those services to people. But I didn't really know much about basic income. And it wasn't until the 2015 election that your group actually asked me to come to chat about it. And I'm going to be totally honest with you. A lot of time, you know, as a politician, you get invited and asked to listen to a lot of these pitches and ideas. And of course, I do them whenever I can, but I usually kind of go into them skeptical, because 9 out of 10 times, you know, they don't really, you know, I can kind of poke holes in them and I question, how good the program really could be. But from the beginning, I was really taken by this idea of a basic income, having seen, the delivery of services and perhaps the inefficiency of it. And seeing an opportunity to deliver more services in what I actually saw as a more efficient way. And this concept that you can, strip away a lot of the, resources that go into delivering programs, monitoring people, checking up on people, and use that money to actually help give people the resources that they need. I saw as such an efficient way of doing it. Your thoughts on that, on the efficiency of basic income?
Exactly. I mean, we've always appreciated your understanding, your grasp of these ideas, and as you've said, it's informed in part by your experiences as a mayor. So, we think about social assistance recipients when we think about basic income, because all of them in the country live in poverty, in deep poverty. And that system was really set up based on, 19th century moral values. Yeah. that people who live in poverty have somehow brought it upon themselves, and there's something suspect about them. There's some kind of character flaw or weakness, and they need to be surveilled and punished, and you need to kind of crack the whip to get them to work, that somehow they're inherently lazy. And so the whole social assistance system is set up on those assumptions, which are, are demonstrably false.
Do you think that that's a stigma that also needs to be addressed in you know, getting the general public to buy into basic income? Because I actually honestly believe that even a lot of people who see themselves as very, very fiscally responsible and tend to be more on the right side of the political spectrum, if they really understood basic income, they could actually see that it makes financially prudent sense to implement it. But I think it's this stigma that you've just mentioned that is attached to basic income that perhaps would drive a lot of those people away from thinking it would be, you know, a very useful tool. What are your thoughts on the stigma associated with it?
So I think, you know, that idea that we see it all the time, you know, if you give people money, they won't want to work. So there's this idea that somehow people are inherently lazy and that if you give them a bare bones, you know, $2,000 a month or less, that somehow everyone's going to be happy sitting home, you know, drinking beer and watching soap operas or something. You know, it just, to me, it's, you know, we work for so many reasons and we take a lot of pride in our work. We see that all the time. And there's, and I mean, the flip side of that is that there's lots of, a lot of work that gets done that isn't paid that basic income could help compensate for. The reality is that about 70%, 65 to 70% of people who live in poverty actually already have a job. Sometimes they have more than one job and they still, you know, they still go to work because it offers benefits other than the income, and the income is important. So efficiency, yes. And social assistance traps people in poverty. There's so many barriers and so many rules that discourage people from seeking employment. Basic income, we have the basic income pilot. We have some data from that. I mean, not the data we'd hoped to have, but yeah. You know, most people who had jobs going into the basic income pilots, they either stayed with their job or they found better jobs or they went into education to improve their prospects.
And you're referring obviously to the pilot project that started in Ontario, but then when the current government came along, it stopped. And this is the one that stopped. This is the one you're referring to, right?
I am referring to that, yes.
Yeah. You know, there's a couple things that you touched on there that I find interesting, but just, you know, for context. So basic income, you know, say for example, you established it at $22,000 a year or something like that. That would mean that everybody would get $22,000 a year at a bare minimum. So if something happened and somebody, you know, was completely unemployed for some reason and had absolutely no income, they would get a check or deposit from your government for $22,000. But, you know, if you were somebody that didn't work a little bit and say you worked and you earned $12,000, your benefit would be $10,000. So the idea is that everybody gets to this minimum level. And so I understand if our research is correct, that you're a supporter of basic income, but not universal basic income. Can you explain to me what the difference is there, if I have that correct?
So you, since the pandemic started, I'm sure you've noticed that the, you know, hashtag UBI is everywhere in social media, which, you know, stands for universal basic income. So there's two main models of basic income. One is, you know, the universal basic income that is what's called a demigrant model. So in the demigrant model, everybody in the country would get that $22,000 a year. And then it would be, for those who had higher incomes, it would be clawed back later. So that's one model. The other basic model is, it's sometimes referred to as a negative income tax, or the acronym is NIT, which isn't very flattering. But in that scheme, you would get a basic income. I mean, there's a based on your tax returns, and if as your income decreased, the amount of the basic income would increase, and it would gradually taper off. So at some point, decided by the government, you would no longer get it. So the downside of the universal model, the UBI or the Demigrant model, is the upfront cost. It would cost a lot of money. And right. Basic Income Canada Network has actually done that costing. And, you know, we know that people who are wealthy have lots of ways of not paying the same amount of taxes. So the idea that you could claw it back may or may not be the case. So in the targeted model, it's universal in the sense that that Medicare is universal. So when you need it, it's there for you. And that's the kind of basic income that I would argue would be fiscally responsible and easy to implement. So it's universal access in the sense that when people need it, once their income falls below a certain level, it's there for them.
Right. Okay. Okay. That's I definitely understand that better now. So we've talked about like the financial part of this and how it could benefit individuals financially to give them security. I'm curious what your thoughts are on, because I've read some high level reports from some Scandinavian countries that have adopted similar policies, and I'm curious what your analysis or your research has indicated as it relates to the transformation of your marketplace. Some people think, oh well, now so many more people, like you said, will suddenly become lazy and not work. But in reality, I've seen some suggestions that it actually increases entrepreneurship, and in the other department that you're heavily involved in, gender studies, it actually gets more women into the workplace. Can you talk a little bit about what you've discovered on that front?
So it makes a lot of sense that if you knew that you had enough money to put food on the table and keep a roof over your head, just for basics, you know, $22,000 a year is not very much money, but, you know, lots of people do manage on that amount of money. It's easy to imagine that you would set up a small business, not have to worry about those first few years when you're getting up and running. There is evidence, certainly a little bit of evidence from the pilot and from other countries, that when people have that kind of security, the stability and the security, the knowing that that money is coming in, they're much more likely to be thinking about the future, to take chances, to take risks, to feel that they're supported to contribute to their society. So I think it could have lots of effects in that sense. It also, because people who are low income spend their money in their local communities, it also has a multiplier effect on local economies.
That is an incredibly good point, because I think what a lot of people don't really realize about the CERB program is it's just as much about keeping the economy going as it is putting money in people's hands and their pockets. And you know that the people who are accessing the CERB money are not putting it in tax-free savings accounts. They're out there spending it, you know, because they need to. And, you know, it's to that point that you know, this is the people who would be receiving the basic income would be spending it. It's not like they're putting it into GICs and, you know, and then you get that multiplier effect as it works its way through the economy, right? Like, so from, you know, I studied economics at Queen's, you know, that's my background, and it's always been marketplace. But for so many reasons, this model just seems to fit well into that marketplace kind of assessment.
Exactly. So, you know, I've heard it described, again, since the pandemic, I've heard this idea of basic income described as radical. It's actually not very radical at all.
It's not.
At least from my perspective. As you say, it fits very well in the keeping the economy going and supporting people to start small businesses. The other thing it could really do, and I think is really important for us in Canada, because we have a publicly funded healthcare system, is to recognize the incredible healthcare costs of keeping people in poverty. So we know that when people are poor, they can't eat a healthy diet. The stress of living in poverty is devastating. People turn to, you know, addictive behaviors to help cope. And so what we see is that as you don't have to give people a lot of money, and that stress disappears. They take better care of themselves. They're able to give up their cigarettes and their alcohol addictions. It's transformative. And we saw this in the basic income pilot. We saw in the MINCOM in the Manitoba experiment from the 1970s that visits to the hospital emergencies dropped. It's the effects on health, on physical health and mental health are so profound. So it's, and you know, Daniel Martin, the physician at Women's College in Toronto, has said, you know, if basic income were a drug, we'd be putting it in the water because of the healthcare savings. And, you know, it's probably one of the most important things we could do to alleviate the financial pressures on our healthcare system.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think you really hit the nail on the head there when, you know, if you give people some more of those fundamental resources that they need, you know, it means, you know, they might go and visit their doctor sooner and, you know, start doing some of the preventative stuff so that you don't end up having to bear the burden of the really expensive costs down the road, right? And yeah. And I think that fits into it perfectly. You know, we mentioned the pilot project a couple of times. I really liked the idea of the pilot project and getting good Canadian data on it, because from a legislation perspective or a politician's perspective, you're very weary about something that is so, it could be so expensive depending on how you look at it. And the fact that little variables changing here or there could result in billions of dollars. So having good data through a pilot project that's unique to Canada, I think is incredibly important. And I know from, you know, studying it in Parliament and trying to implement a model definitely needs that kind of research. Do you think that there will, maybe it's a better question for me, but, you know, do you think that there will ever be that opportunity to get that good data? One of my colleagues, Wayne Easter, who's a member from PEI, a number of us signed a letter in support of PEI, you know, doing a pilot project just in PEI as anyway, just to get this started. What do you think of the concept of the pilot project, the need for it, and, you know, where it should be, how it should be implemented?
Well, let me go first to the cancellation of the Ontario basic income pilot, which was devastating. That was such a betrayal. It was incredible betrayal. Doug Ford in the provincial election promised that he would maintain the pilot. And the people who were enrolled, he really betrayed their trust, many of whom were reluctant to sign up in the first place because they feared exactly what happened, that the rug would be pulled out from underneath them. If he had allowed that to continue, we would have data right now to inform this discussion that we're having right now and the other discussions, I'm sure, that are happening, you know, in around cabinet tables in this country. So it infuriates me, and I think it was unconscionable.
Do you think that they were almost afraid of the result?
I think they were
afraid to see. Yeah, yeah,
I think they were afraid of the result. And the you know, we have some data that's been collected in a, you know, much less systematic way, and it all points to positive results. So I think they were afraid. You know, I've heard Evelyn Forger is an economist in Manitoba who brought to light the MINCOM study from the 70s. And I've heard her say that, you know, the right was afraid of the results because of how effective it was. And the left was afraid of the results because of the cost. So there wasn't a lot of incentive to get the data out. But to PEI, you know, PEI is all set. Everyone there is just waiting. They're ready to go. All four political parties in PEI support the idea of using the island as a pilot. I know that Wayne Easter and others, the other MPs from PEI, are keen. And it makes a lot of sense to use PEI in the sense that it's a province. So we could work out some of the kinks in terms of the, what's required to integrate basic income into, a very complex social services system. The other thing I like about it is really the parallel with Medicare, because of course, Saskatchewan was the provincial lead on Medicare, and then was able to, we rolled it out across the country. So to me, it's a small place. Not a lot of people are going to move there just because there's a basic income pilot. It just makes so much sense to me to use it as a pilot test site. So Mark, when are we going to get another pilot?
I'll tell you, I can even say that within the Liberal Party, it's continually being something that's talked about, especially even right now during this time. I'm definitely in favor of that. I'll tell you though, and it's a really interesting point, as we were kind of like joking about, are people afraid of seeing the results? It just kind of makes you wonder like how the politics gets into this, but I see it on so many different issues. And I guess what I can say is that politics and political parties, in my opinion, seem to find their niche on an issue and they kind of attach themselves to it, whether it's the environment or whatever it is. And then they build their base around that. And as long as their base is empowered by this idea that we're creating a welfare state and that people are just going to, use basic income just to, mooch off the people. And so as long as you continue to have that kind of stigma attached to it, there will always be some kind of opposition. But there's also a time when in these issues, you get to a certain tipping point, like with the environment, where you have a vast majority of people who are in favor of it, that even that party that, or the politicians that are pushing against it, quite often find themselves in a position where they have to start changing their position on it. So, okay, we do believe in climate change now, but you know what I mean? And so it's the same idea. So, and I can honestly say that I see in the political landscape, this kind of shift with basic income, in particular in the last few years. I think it's a good sign to see that we're going towards that, and we have to keep pushing it. The politicians that believe in it have to keep pushing it. The advocates and the groups like yours have to keep pushing it, because by doing that, we're educating people. And as people become educated on it and start saying, like I did 5 or 6 years ago, that actually makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Then it will become more and more challenging for there to be opposition on it.
Yes. And that's partly why I'm so, really devastated that we don't have that data from the Ontario pilot right now.
And of course, the other challenge that we have in Canada is because of our constitution and the way that our jurisdictional boundaries are set up, you really need collaboration between different levels of government to make this happen. The federal and the provincial governments both need to be on board, which is what you're seeing in PEI, which is why there might be an opportunity for that to happen. And therefore, that's what leads me to conclude that the people have to buy into this and believe in it. And so I think the campaigns should be just as much focused on educating people on it as they are trying to convince politicians of it. Because once we educate people, then it's like a snowball rolling and you can't really stop it.
So is that your advice for our basic income groups, our network across the country, that we should be educating the people?
Yeah, I would say yes. I didn't realize that but no, absolutely. I say this about a lot of those political ideas. I often say this to people who have these great ideas, and they make sense. And I say, okay, but people have to buy into it. And if we can get people to buy into it, then the governments, any government is going to go with it because they realize they kind of have to. But yes, I would say that, you know, the focus should be just as much on educating people on why this is so important as it is to educate politicians.
So I think, I mean, in a way, that's one of the gifts that the virus has given us, you know,
because perhaps a silver lining there.
You know, this, the CERB, I think, has really is showing, I mean, I think there's huge support for it. And, you know, the federal government, I mean, I give them a lot of, give you and the prime minister and our government a lot of credit and for how quickly, you know, you put it in place and people see that. So I think, you know, the last poll I saw said that 70% of Canadians support this idea. So that's amazing. So I think, you know, people are seeing with CERB the benefits of that income floor.
And if we had had some form of basic income in place, you almost wouldn't have even needed the CERB, correct?
Exactly.
Because it would have just taken its place.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, obviously a lot more money would have poured into it, but the structure would have been there.
The structure and the infrastructure would have already been there. It's just a matter of changing payment amounts in terms of, as opposed to, you know, developing the whole system.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, Elaine, thanks so much for taking the time to chat about this. It's a topic that I'm always interested in talking about. So whenever you guys want to come by the office and chat about it, I'm definitely available to do that. So
wow, that's fantastic. And I understand that you're also sponsoring Basic Income Day on Parliament Hill in the fall. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's fantastic.
I hope it's going to happen. And I kind of thought of that when I said, come by my office, obviously right now during the pandemic. But and in the fall, we're sponsoring that. I really hope that it still happens and that we can still do it in given the circumstances. But even if we can't, we'll find a way to continue pushing the message. And then as soon as we can, we'll be there to keep pushing it along.
That's great. Thank you for your work, Mark.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Thanks a lot, Elaine, and have a great day.
Thank you. Bye.